Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management, Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You've seen gas prices, right? And how much groceries cost? So you'll agree that what I'm about to ask is a fair question. How can the experts say inflation's tame, that it's right about where the Federal Reserve wants it? Does Ben Bernanke not drive or eat, do you think? No, he's just got this little trick economists use, and we got a glimpse of it today, something called the core CPI. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Duke Executive MBA, developing leaders and accelerating careers around the world with 4 top-ranked executive MBA programs for working professionals. More at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, the 15th of May. Great to have you here. A core economic report works something like this. Take the statistic of the moment, which today happens to be the Consumer Price Index. Add up all the various components to get the headline number, up 0.4% last month. Now, strip out things that change a lot. Food's one. Energy costs are another. That way you don't get a skewed picture of inflation as it rises or as it falls. The core rate last month was, to channel Mr. Bernanke here, a tame 0.2%. All of that said, just because economists don't count gas prices when they're figuring inflation doesn't mean consumers can ignore them, too. Along with the CPI report today, there was a notice out from the Energy Department. Pat Loeb reports gas inventories are low, and despite high prices, demand just keeps on rising.
The Energy Information Administration told the Senate today fuel prices should start to drop as more refineries come back online. The administration's Joanne Shore says fires and power outages unexpectedly took some refineries out of commission this spring, just as global demand increased. Average gas prices hit a record $3.10 a gallon this week, and that's not all.
We have not seen the full effect of wholesale prices at retail either yet. Wholesale prices have gone up more than retail, so I'm afraid we still could see more price increases.
It's not just the price at the pump that's hurting consumers. More farm products are going into alternative fuel, and that makes food prices higher. Economist Diane Swank at Mesirow Financial says it undermines the Fed's success at keeping inflation in other sectors in check.
It's sort of an economic purgatory for the Federal Reserve that's looking at growth weaken at the same time that these food prices are going up along with oil. They like to see both of those recede.
And so would consumers. I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
That 310 average price Pat mentioned puts us above the records we hit right after Hurricane Katrina, which is what you call a convenient segue to our next item. The biggest investment in Mississippi's Gulf Coast since the hurricane was announced today. Casino giant Harrah's says it will spend $700 million for a casino and resort in Biloxi. They'll be teaming up with Gulf Coast native and margarita man Jimmy Buffett. The casino industry has been coming back pretty quickly on the Mississippi Gulf, far faster than the rest of the economy there. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli tells us why.
Three casinos reopened shortly after Katrina. Another five have come back since. A ninth is coming soon, and now a Harrah's project called Margaritaville. There's a reason the economically important casino industry has recovered the fastest, says Marianne Hill at Mississippi's Center for Policy Research and Planning.
There was legislation passed to speed along its rebuilding. Private industry is able to get the funds they need to rebuild, and the state has been very amenable to their plans.
Hill says progress has been slower in most everything else.
What has not been proceeding as rapidly is the rebuilding of the community on the coast. Housing has been going much more slowly, and there's also problems related to just getting the community up and running again.
Which isn't to say folks aren't happy the casinos are coming. Larry Barnett of the Regional Development Commission says the initial boost of building jobs for casinos is also creating economic engines for the rest of the coast.
The other good thing about the casinos is as these casinos come back, they provide meeting space where we can then go out and attract conferences, trade shows, and conventions.
And Barnett's hoping the Harrah's announcement can stimulate a wider sense of confidence in the Gulf Coast economy. The funny thing about all this is that Mississippi's statewide economy is doing better than it has in a while. The main stimulant? The flood of money for Katrina rebuilding. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
The manufacturing conglomerate Tyco is hoping $3 billion will put its past firmly in the rearview mirror. Today, the company, once run by Dennis Kozlowski, announced it'll pay up to settle shareholder lawsuits. Kozlowski, you might remember, is in jail for his role in taking $600 million from the cash register. It seems everybody wants a piece of China these days, and the U.S. stock market is no exception. Reuters is reporting NASDAQ is talking with regulators about setting up shop in Beijing, and Marketplace's Amy Scott reports that may be just the beginning.
China's stock market has been on such a tear, it's no wonder U.S. players want in on the game. More and more Chinese companies are going public, and U.S. stock exchanges want those companies to list their shares with them. NASDAQ, in particular, could use the business. Earlier this year, the company failed in its bid to buy the London Stock Exchange. Bill Klein is a capital markets consultant with Akai Solutions. He says one reason NASDAQ wanted to buy the LSE was its presence in Asia. He says opening a China office is a plan B.
One could look at this as somewhat of a play by NASDAQ to go directly into Asia, establish their own presence, and try and replicate the success that has primarily benefited the LSE over the past couple of years.
NASDAQ is under more pressure now that its chief competitor, the New York Stock Exchange, has merged with Europe's electronic exchange, Euronext. It's also formed partnerships in India and Japan, and the NYSE, too, plans to open an official office in China. Consultant Brad Bailey with iTake Group says that's partly to attract more listings, but also perhaps to pursue some kind of alliance with Chinese stock exchanges.
Large investors are really scouring the planet for opportunities, and the exchanges coming together and going cross-border adds to the efficiencies and ease in which investors can, you know, get access to other markets.
As they await final approval to set up shop in China, both the NASDAQ and the NYSE are pressing ahead there. They've each attracted half a dozen Chinese listings so far this year. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
That inflation report turned some heads early today, but by the end, stocks had moved kind of sideways. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's sort of a hidden battle that goes on behind all the buying and selling in the world's markets every day. It's not about the markets per se. It's about the data, the raw numbers that are generated when trading takes place, prices and volumes and yields. Until today, there were three companies fighting that fight. Now, there are two. The financial news giant Reuters, of which we're a client, has agreed to merge with its Canadian rival, Thomson. The price tag's a bit more than $17 billion. The deal would put the new company ahead of the current number one, Bloomberg. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports.
Antitrust regulators are sure to have a field day with this deal, given that a combined Reuters and Thomson adds up to the most powerful financial data service in the world. The unions that represent Reuters have other concerns. They have to do with a list of ethics principles that governs Reuters.
The trust principles are designed to keep Reuters independent and to keep us free of bias and to keep us out of the hands of one owner who might tend to influence the organization in one direction or another.
That's Peter Sakay of the Newspaper Guild at Reuters. He says unions are concerned about a $500 million cost reduction that's being bandied about and whether jobs are on the line. The company's not saying how it'll slash the budget, but Sakay isn't reassured.
This is supposed to be about expanding the company. This is supposed to be about two companies that are supposed to complement each other.
Joe Turo of the Annenberg School of Communication says the value of financial market data is steeped in over 150 years of history.
the guy who called himself Reuters, used carrier pigeons to make up the difference between breaks in the cable, that is the telegraph cable, in Europe, with a realization that if you get information to European capitals and eventually to London faster than ships can go, then you'd make money.
And in the case of the Reuters union with Thompson, a lot of money will be made, an estimated $11 billion of it. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
The news has been in the news the past couple of weeks. There's that Reuters-Thompson deal Lisa was just telling us about. And Rupert Murdoch, as I'm sure you've heard, wants to buy the Wall Street Journal. He's asked for a face-to-face meeting with the family that controls the Dow Jones Company, but otherwise, nothing much new to report on that. The conventional wisdom about newspapers is that they're a dying breed, that falling circulation and disappearing ad revenues will drive most of them out of business, or at least out of print and onto the web. But before you write that particular obituary, look at India, home to 300 big papers that are read by almost 160 million people. Miranda Kennedy reports.
Dozens of customers are lined up outside the classified ads office of Mumbai's famous city tabloid, Midday. They're waiting their turn at the window. Then they dictate their ad to announce a name change or post for a job vacancy at their company. The agent types it up and prints it out on a stuttering printer. Advertising hasn't yet gone digital in India. This antiquated media model generates hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for papers like Midday, which has about 160,000 readers. Not bad for a local paper, but not huge either. Yet editor Tariq Ansari says his revenues have increased 20 times in the 17 years he's been running the paper.
Because we're all, you know, riding the crest of this huge advertising wave.
Newspaper readership is flattening in the U.S. because so many people read online now instead. But in India, fewer than 2% of adults have internet access, so newspaper readers are actually proliferating.
Economic growth has led to development, and development has led to literacy. Outside of the big cities, Hindi newspapers have just exploded, fueled by neoliterates, people who are literate for the first time. So if I've just started reading, you know, the big thing in my life is to carry a newspaper because it's a sign that says I read. And that's a powerful statement to make.
In India's cities, there's what Ansari calls a second wave of literacy, that is, from the local language to English. And it seems every other month someone launches a new newspaper to meet the demand. Raju Narasetty recently joined their ranks. A couple months ago, he left his lofty position as deputy managing editor at the Wall Street Journal Europe to move to India and start a business paper. Or, to be exact, the country's fifth English language business newspaper. But he's betting there's room for one more.
It's still the cheapest form of getting information. It's less than what you'd pay for a cup of tea on a street kiosk. Television is starting to really make a lot of inroads, but it's pretty expensive. So while it's spreading, I think newspapers will play a pretty strong role for quite a while to come.
Narasetty's paper, which is called Mint and takes 20% of its content from the Wall Street Journal, literally costs less than the paper it's printed on. Subscribers pay about 2 cents a copy, which means Narasetty loses 9 cents on every issue. But he's not worried.
I used to sit in meetings in Europe where if the advertising people said that we're going to have a flat quarter, we would all be very, very happy about it. I've sat in meetings here where the CEO pounds his fist saying that 40% is completely unacceptable and that we are like slacking off and why is it not 60% growth? So that's the kind of environment India is in right now.
So although some of his colleagues thought he was nuts to leave the journal to launch a paper in the third world, it was an easy decision for Narasetty. And he already feels vindicated. He says almost every day he gets an email from an American journalist asking him if he has any openings. In Mumbai, I'm Miranda Kennedy for Marketplace.
Mortgage lenders are sick and tired, and they're not going to take it anymore. They want their money back, is more to the point. An industry report out today shows foreclosures were up 62% in April over the same time a year ago, largely because borrowers have gotten into trouble with risky and subprime mortgages. More than 147,000 homes were foreclosed on last month. Subprime lenders are going bankrupt, and Congress has been holding hearings on predatory lending. But a commentator and economist, Susan Lee, still thinks there's an upside to subprime.
Okay, so the subprime mortgage market is plagued with fraud and abuse. But what would the housing market look like without subprimes? For starters, home ownership wouldn't be at a record high of 69%. It would be several percentage points lower. And those percentage points represent lots of would-be minority buyers, blacks and Latinos, who would have been shut out of the market. Credit is a good thing. It allows people to use the services of something without having to pay for it all at once up front. Credit lets people drive cars, go to college, and live in houses. It's axiomatic that an efficient economy runs on a well-functioning credit market. Until the subprime mortgage market came along, about 17 years ago, home ownership was mostly restricted to the rich and middle class. It wasn't until financial innovations like variable rate mortgages and securitization that housing credit was extended to lower income people. The problem is that lower income people are greater credit risks. Their rates of delinquency and foreclosure are higher than richer people, and they have to pay higher interest rates to compensate lenders for that risk. And so it's no wonder that as soon as interest rates started climbing and the housing bubble began popping, the subprime market began to totter. But let's not exaggerate. So far, fewer than 15% of subprime borrowers have been late with their mortgage payments. And even if 20% of subprime mortgages end up in foreclosure, it still leaves the other 80% of subprime borrowers cutting their own lawns and, most important, creating wealth in the form of home equity. Yes, let's clean up the subprime market and help salvage the homes of people suckered by aggressive lending. But let's not forget, the subprime market serves poor minorities, and that's a good thing.
Economist Susan Lee lives in New York City. You can send us your thoughts through our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, not-so-utopian societies.
Every socialist society, there is not motivation to work hard because it's not important what you do. You finish your work day and you pay the same.
But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so take your pick. It was another record-breaking day on Wall Street, or it was a losing day for the stock market. They're both right. The Dow Industrials did their own thing today, closing at yet another new high. The trading day ended with the Dow at 13,383. That's a gain of 37 points, around a quarter of 1%. The blue chips benefited from today's news of easing inflation, but that optimism didn't extend beyond the Dow. The NASDAQ finished down 21 points, 8-tenths of 1% at 2525. There's a song in there somewhere. And the broader S&P 500 lost a point, about a 10th of 1%, closing at 1501. General Motors was one of the Dow stocks that boosted the blue chip. Shares in the country's biggest automaker accelerated around 4.5% thanks to an upgrade of GM by Lehman Brothers. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. The Marketplace Health Desk is supported by the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation working toward a high-performance health system. On the web at commonwealthfund.org. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for April. The Joint Economic Committee talks about the explosive costs of caring for elders and the impact on family finances and business competition. And the first Oscars were handed out on May 16, 1929, in a banquet room of the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. About 250 people attended. Tickets were $5. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's planning a vote on the latest immigration reform plan tomorrow. The outcome's still up in the air, so supporters and opponents of all the various proposals are taking the opportunity to make their opinions heard, including the hotel industry. CEOs of six big hotel chains have written an open letter to Congress demanding action now. One of them is Bill Marriott, Chairman and CEO of Marriott International. Mr. Marriott, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good talk to you.
Why did you feel the need to write this letter?
Well, we are very concerned about the immigration problem we have in the country today. We think that something needs to be done just as soon as possible. We're seeing that states and local governments are passing laws regulating immigration, and there's going to be a very confusing patchwork of different laws around the country, and we operate in all 50 states and most state capitals, and we really need to get a comprehensive immigration law that we can all abide by and operate by.
All right, sir. So if you could write the bill that Congress would consider, what would it say?
We are not in favor of amnesty. We do believe that there has to be a pathway to citizenship, however. There certainly has to be some sort of a penalty or some sort of process going here where people can become citizens who come into our country to work. We need these workers. We have a shortage today of hourly workers coming into our hotels. We are very short. We opened a new hotel a few months ago, and we couldn't even open all rooms because we didn't have enough people to clean the rooms. And so our need for workers from countries abroad is extremely, extremely high.
You've written to members of Congress. You've written to members of the president's cabinet. Have you talked to organized labor at all in this country about their feelings on this?
No, I have not.
Why not?
Well, I simply don't believe that that's necessary. I think right now that that they're not writing the laws. The legislators are writing the laws, and we haven't really had any discussions with organized labor.
But it's an inherently political process, sir, as I'm sure you understand.
It's a political process, but it's not a labor union process. This is a congressional, a government process to make sure that there's a pathway for people to remain employed when they come to this country and apply for citizenship and have a path to citizenship.
What's your hope that this is actually going to get done? Are you confident of an immigration bill?
I'm reasonably confident. That seems to have pretty strong support. I think there's some people who want to tweak the bill to make it very, very hard for immigrant workers to establish themselves in this country, and I think that's a mistake because we need these workers.
What's at stake if you don't get the workers, Mr. Marriott?
If we don't get the workers, the growth in the hospitality industry, the restaurant industry, is going to slow markedly. And I think it could cause labor costs in this country to escalate tremendously. We could have a runaway inflation, and we could at the same time have a recession. We could have the worst of all worlds on the economic front.
Bill Marriott is the chairman and CEO of Marriott International. Mr. Marriott, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Jordan's King Abdullah and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert met today to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Olmert said he's ready to talk to Arab leaders about a peace plan. The king called for a timetable, and he cautioned Olmert to stop building settlements on occupied lands. Kibbutzim, or communal farms and factories, sit on some of those disputed territories. And when they started in the early 1900s, there were places where no one was supposed to have more than his neighbor. In exchange for an honest day's work, the kibbutz took care of electricity and food and medicine, even weddings or funerals. But a century later, collective economics aren't working out so well, and rising debt has forced more than half the kibbutzim in Israel to at least partially privatize, as Shia Levitt reports.
Kibbutz Alamot is located on a hillside overlooking the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan Valley. From here, you can see Syria and Lebanon. Kibbutz business manager Shmuel Boglasowski is checking in on the dairy goat shed, where newborns are playing on scattered straw and munching on food pellets. He oversees everything here, from the chicken farm to agricultural fields to real estate. For many years, he worked without a salary, but he started to feel that not everyone was pulling his weight.
Every socialist society, there is not motivation to work hard, because it's not important what you do. You finish your work day and you pay the same.
The kibbutz was plagued with growing debt and a severe decline in membership. In 2000, the kibbutz privatized. They instituted differential salaries for their workers and began to charge for services that were previously free. Today, the kibbutz is no longer in financial crisis. About a third of the families have remodeled, even doubled, their homes.
Now, everybody, even the people who work with a low salary, have more money than before.
But not everyone agrees. Esti Rosen says her family makes just enough to pay their bills. The old system took into account that she had four kids, but today she and her husband make the same minimum wage as anyone else.
My son is sick with a muscle disease, and they said, oh, don't worry, everything is going to be okay. It's not so. It's almost 10 pills from here for each time, three times a day.
Her son's medications now eat up a third of her monthly salary, and she's not sure how she'll be able to repay the kibbutz loan for his treatment. The old system was supposed to come up with the funds to pay for each member's medical needs. Rosen sometimes feels let down.
I didn't expect everything, but I know that I gave my youth to work here, and then when they change it, they change almost everything.
Daycare, health insurance, everything comes out of pocket now. Education would be one way to get ahead, but the kibbutz no longer funds it. Many families have little or no savings to help their college-age children.
I will have to pay for my own school tuition for 3 years and my living there, and it's going to be a lot harder than it would have been had the kibbutz stayed socialist.
But 21-year-old Ofra Ben Ephraim says the system works better now in other ways. She's got a job at the local gas station, and she looks forward to saving and spending her own money.
If we want to travel, then we can afford to do it. Unlike before, they wouldn't pay for like a trip to South America. But now, after we work, we could pay for ourselves.
No matter how people feel on a personal level, most will say the decision to change was right for the kibbutz. But this doesn't dampen their nostalgia for the old socialist ideal.
It's a little sad for us to see that the place where we built, we must change this. But we need the change not because we believe that capitalism is better. We believe that if we want to keep the kibbutz, we must make the changes.
There are still many kibbutzim that do practice the socialist model, but most are financially stable enough for now to have the choice. In northern Israel, I'm Shia Levitt for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note from the Marketplace desk of We Are Not Making This Up. This fall, ABC is going to air a sitcom based on those Geico caveman commercials. The half-hour show, titled, appropriately enough, Cavemen, follows three 30-something Neanderthals who are trying to make it in modern-day Atlanta. The show was announced today during ABC's upfront presentation. That's when the networks reveal their new season lineup and book billions in advertising dollars. No word yet on how much advertisers will pony up for the prehistoric series, but if you want to set your TiVos, it's scheduled for Tuesdays at 8 this fall for, you know, as long as it lasts. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 37 points, 0.25%. The record's now 13,383. The NASDAQ lost 21 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 nicked off a point. That's 0.1%. Thanks to Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, you remember those Tupperware parties? Well, the demographics changed a bit.
Men have arrived in Tupperland. Even the rapper Ice-T, one of the toughest guys in the world, held a Tupperware party for charity a while back.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.